Chapter 74. The original of the portrait comes to England. 'Twas announced in the family that my Lord Castlewood would arrive, having a confidential French gentleman in his suite, who acted as secretary to his lordship, and who, being a papist, and a foreigner of a good family, though now in rather a menial place, would have his meals served in his chamber, and not with the domestics of the house. The Viscountess gave up her bedchamber contiguous to her daughter's, and having a large convenient closet attached to it, in which a bed was put up, ostensibly for Monsieur Baptiste, the Frenchman, though, 'tis needless to say, when the doors of the apartments were locked, and the two guests retired within it, the young Viscount became the servant of the illustrious prince whom he entertained, and gave up gladly the more convenient and airy chamber and bed to his master. Madame Beatrix also retired to the upper region, her chamber being converted into a sitting room for my lord. The better to carry the deceit, Beatrix affected to grumble before the servants, and to be jealous that she was turned out of her chamber to make way for my lord. No small preparations were made, you may be sure, and no slight tremor of expectation caused the hearts of the gentle ladies of Castlewood to flutter before the arrival of the personages who were about to honor their house. The chamber was ornamented with flowers, the bed covered with the very finest of linen, the two ladies insisting on making it themselves, and kneeling down at the bedside, and kissing the sheets out of respect for the web that was to hold the sacred person of a king. The toilet was of silver and crystal. There was a copy of Icon-Basilike laid on the writing table. A portrait of the martyred king hung always over the mantel, having a sword of my poor Lord Castlewood underneath it, and a little picture or emblem which the widow loved always to have before her eyes on waking, and in which the hair of her lord and her two children was worked together. Her books of private devotions, as they were all of the English church, she carried away with her to the upper apartment, which she destined for herself. The ladies showed Mr. Esmond, when they were completed, the fond preparations they had made. 'Twas then Beatrix knelt down, and kissed the linen sheets. As for her mother, Lady Castlewood made a curtsy at the door, as she would have done to the altar on entering a church, and owned that she considered the chamber in a manner sacred. The company in the servants' hall never for a moment supposed that these preparations were made for any other person than the young Viscount, the lord of the house, whom his fond mother had been for so many years without seeing. Both ladies were perfect housewives, having the greatest skill in the making of confections, scented waters, and tea, and keeping a notable superintendence over the kitchen. Calves enough were killed to feed an army of prodigal sons, Esmond thought, and laughed when he came to wait on the ladies, on the day when the guests were to arrive, to find two pairs of the finest and roundest arms to be seen in England. My Lady Castlewood was remarkable for this beauty of her person, covered with flour up above the elbows, and preparing paste, and turning rolling pins in the housekeeper's closet. The guest would not arrive till supper time, and my lord would prefer having that meal in his own chamber. You may be sure the brightest plate of the house was laid out there, and can understand why it was that the ladies insisted that they alone would wait upon the young chief of the family. Taking horse, Colonel Esmond rode rapidly to Rochester, and there awaited the king in that very town where his father had last set his foot on the English shore. A room had been provided at an inn there for my Lord Castlewood and his servant, and Colonel Esmond timed his ride so well that he had scarce been half an hour in the place, and was looking over the balcony into the yard of the inn, when two travellers rode in at the inn gate, and the colonel running down, the next moment embraced his dear young lord. My lord's companion, acting the part of a domestic, dismounted, and was for holding the Viscount's stirrup, but Colonel Esmond, calling to his own man, who was in the court, bade him take the horses and settle with the lad who had ridden the post along with the two travellers. crying out in a cavalier tone in the French language to my lord's companion, and affecting to grumble that my lord's fellow was a Frenchman, and did not know the money or habits of the country. Why, man, will see to the horses, Baptist, says Colonel Esmond Colin, do you understand English? Very little. Oh, follow my lord and wait upon him at dinner in his own room. The landlord and his people came up presently bearing the dishes. 'Twas well they made a noise and stir in the gallery, or they might have found Colonel Esmond on his knee before Lord Castlewood's servant, welcoming his majesty to his kingdom, and kissing the hand of the king. We told the landlord that the Frenchman would wait on his master, and Esmond's man was ordered to keep sentry in the gallery without the door. The prince dined with a good appetite, laughing and talking very gaily, and condescendingly bidding his two companions to sit with him at table. He was in better spirits than poor Frank Castlewood, who Esmond thought might be woe-begging on account of parting with his divine Clotilda. But the prince wishing to take a short siesta after dinner, and retiring to an inner chamber, where there was a bed, the cause of poor Frank's discomfiture came out, and bursting into tears, with many expressions of fondness, friendship, and humiliation, the faithful lad gave his kinsman to understand that he now knew all the truth, and the sacrifices which Colonel Esmond had made for him. Seeing no good in acquainting poor Frank with that secret, Mr. Esmond had entreated his mistress also not to reveal it to her son. The prince had told the poor lad all as they were riding from Dover. Colin, I had as lief he had shot me. Cousin, Frank said, Colin, I knew you were the best, and the bravest, and the kindest of all men. So the enthusiastic young fellow went on, but I never thought I owed you what I do, and can scarce bear the weight of the obligation. I stand in the place of your father, says Mr. Esmond, kindly, and sure a father may dispossess himself in favor of his son. I abdicate the 20 crown, and invest you with the kingdom of Brentford. Don't be a fool and cry, you make a much taller and handsomer viscount than ever I could. But the fond boy, with oaths and protestations, laughter and incoherent outbreaks of passionate emotion, could not be got, for some little time, to put up with Esmond's raillery, wanted to kneel down to him, and kissed his hand, asked him and implored him to order something, to bid Castlewood give his own life or take somebody else's, anything, so that he might show his gratitude for the generosity Esmond showed him. The K, he laughed, Frank said, pointing to the door where the sleeper was, and speaking in a low tone. Don't think he should have laughed as he told me the story. As we rode along from Dover, talking in French, he spoke about you, and your coming to him at Bar. He called you Le Grand Sirieu, apostrophe Don Bellianus of Greece, and I don't know what names. Mimicking your manner, your Castlewood laughed himself, and he did it very well. He seems to sneer at everything. He is not like a king. Somehow, Harry, I fancy you are like a king. He does not seem to think what a stake we are all playing. He would have stopped at Canterbury to run after a barmaid there, had I not implored him to come on. He hath a house at Chaillot, where he used to go and bury himself for weeks away from the Queen, and with all sorts of bad company, says Frank, with a demure look. You may smile, but I am not the wild fellow I was. No, no, I have been taught better, says Castlewood devoutly, making a sign on his breast. Thou art my dear brave boy, says Colonel Esmond, touched at the young fellow's simplicity, and there will be a noble gentleman at Castlewood so long as my Frank is there. The impetuous young lad was for going down on his knees again, with another explosion of gratitude. But that we heard the voice from the next chamber of the August sleeper, just waking, calling out, Eh, La Fleur, un verre d'eau. His Majesty came out yawning. Pest, says he, upon your English ale, 'tis so strong that, ma foi, it hath turned my head. The effect of the ale was like a spur upon our horses, and we rode very quickly to London, reaching Kensington at nightfall. Mr. Esmond's servant was left behind at Rochester to take care of the tired horses, whilst we had fresh beasts provided along the road. And galloping by the prince's side, the colonel explained to the Prince of Wales what his movements had been, who the friends were that knew of the expedition, whom, as Esmond conceived, the prince should trust, entreating him, above all, to maintain the very closest secrecy until the time should come when his royal highness should appear. The town swarmed with friends of the prince's cause. There were scores of correspondents with Saint Germain's, Jacobites known and secret, great in station and humble, about the court and the queen, in the parliament, church, and among the merchants in the city. The prince had friends numberless in the army, in the privy council, and the officers of state. The great object, as it seemed, to the small band of persons who had concerted that bold stroke, who had brought the queen's brother into his native country, was that his visit should remain unknown till the proper time came, when his presence should surprise friends and enemies alike, and the latter should be found so unprepared and disunited that they should not find time to attack him. We feared more from his friends than from his enemies. The lies and tittle-tattle sent over to St. Germain's by the Jacobite agents about London had done an incalculable mischief to his cause, and woefully misguided him, and it was from these especially that the persons engaged in the present venture were anxious to defend the chief actor in it. Asterisk, asterisk, asterisk. The managers were the bishop, who cannot be hurt by having his name mentioned, a very active and loyal nonconformist divine, a lady in the highest favor at court, with whom Beatrix Esmond had communication, and two noblemen of the greatest rank, and a member of the House of Commons, who was implicated in more transactions than one in behalf of the Stuart family. The party reached London by nightfall, leaving their horses at the posting house over against Westminster, and being ferried over the water, where Lady Esmond's coach was already in waiting. In another hour we were all landed at Kensington, and the mistress of the house had that satisfaction which her heart had yearned after for many years, once more to embrace her son, who, on his side, with all his waywardness, ever retained a most tender affection for his parent. She did not refrain from this expression of her feeling, though the domestics were by, and my Lord Castlewood's attendant stood in the hall. Esmond had to whisper to him in French to take his hat off. Monsieur Baptiste was constantly neglecting his part with an inconceivable levity. More than once on the ride to London, little observations of the stranger, light remarks, and words beckoning the greatest ignorance of the country the prince came to govern, had hurt the susceptibility of the two gentlemen forming his escort, nor could either help owning in his secret mind that they would have had his behavior otherwise, and that the laughter and the lightness, not to say license, which characterized his talk, scarce befitted such a great prince, and such a solemn occasion. Not but that he could act at proper times with spirit and dignity. He had behaved, as we all knew, in a very courageous manner on the field. Esmond had seen a copy of the letter the prince had writ with his own hand, when urged by his friends in England to abjure his religion, and admired that manly and magnanimous reply by which he refused to yield to the temptation. Monsieur Baptiste took off his hat, blushing at the hint Colonel Esmond ventured to give him, and said, "Ennis, L.S. Jolie, la petite mire, foie de chevalier, L.S. Charmant, may slaughter, qui est cette nymph, cette aster qui brille, cette Diane qui descend sur nous?" And he started back, and pushed forward, as Beatrix was descending the stair. She was in colors for the first time at her own house. She wore the diamonds Esmond gave her. It had been agreed between them that she should wear these brilliants on the day when the king should enter the house, and a queen she looked, radiant in charms, and magnificent and imperial in beauty. Castlewood himself was startled by that beauty and splendor. He stepped back and gazed at his sister, as though he had not been aware before, nor was he very likely, how perfectly lovely she was, and I thought blushed as he embraced her. The prince could not keep his eyes off her. He quite forgot his menial part, though he had been schooled to it, and a little light portmanteau prepared, expressly that he should carry it. He pressed forward before my lord Viscount. 'Twas lucky the servant's eyes were busy in other directions, or they must have seen that this was no servant, or at least a very insolent and rude one. Again Colonel Esmond was obliged to cry out, "Baptist," in a loud imperious voice, "have a care to the valise," at which hint the willful young man ground his teeth together with something very like a curse between them, and then gave a brief look of anything but pleasure to his mentor. Being reminded, however, he shouldered the little portmanteau, and carried it up the stair, Esmond preceding him, and a servant with lighted tapers. He flung down his burden sulkily in the bedchamber. "Prince that will wear a crown must wear a mask," says Mr. Esmond in French. "Ah, peste! I see how it is," says Monsieur Baptiste, continuing the talk in French. "He great serious is seriously alarmed for Monsieur Baptiste," broke in the colonel. Esmond neither liked the tone with which the prince spoke of the ladies, nor the eyes with which he regarded them. The bedchamber and the two rooms adjoining it, the closet and the apartment which was to be called my lord's parlor, were already lighted and awaiting their occupier, and the collation laid for my lord's supper. Lord Castlewood and his mother and sister came up the stair a minute afterwards, and, so soon as the domestics had quitted the apartment, Castlewood and Esmond uncovered, and the two ladies went down on their knees before the prince, who graciously gave a hand to each. He looked his part of prince much more naturally than that of servant, which he had just been trying, and raised them both with a great deal of nobility, as well as kindness in his air. "Adam," says he, "my mother will thank your ladyship for your hospitality to her son. For you, madam," turning to Beatrix, "I cannot bear to see so much beauty in such a posture. You will betray Monsieur Baptiste if you kneel to him. Sure 'tis his place rather to kneel to you." A light shone out of her eyes, a gleam bright enough to kindle passion in any breast. There were times when this creature was so handsome that she seemed, as it were, like Venus revealing herself a goddess in a flash of brightness. She appeared so now, radiant, and with eyes bright with a wonderful luster. A pang, as of rage and jealousy, shot through Esmond's heart as he caught the look she gave the prince, and he clenched his hand involuntarily and looked across to Castlewood, whose eyes answered his alarm signal and were also on the alert. The prince gave his subjects an audience of a few minutes, and then the two ladies and Colonel Esmond quitted the chamber. Lady Castlewood pressed his hand as they descended the stair, and the three went down to the lower rooms, where they waited a while till the travelers above should be refreshed and ready for their meal. Esmond looked at Beatrix, blazing with her jewels on her beautiful neck. "Have kept my word," says he, "colon and I mine," says Beatrix, looking down on the diamonds. "Were I the Mogul Emperor," says the colonel, "you should have all that were dug out of Golconda." "These are a great deal too good for me," says Beatrix, dropping her head on her beautiful breast. "Oh, are you all? And when she looked up again, as she did in a moment, and after a sigh, her eyes, as they gazed at her cousin, wore that melancholy and inscrutable look which 'twas always impossible to sound. When the time came for the supper, of which we were advertised by a knocking overhead, Colonel Esmond and the two ladies went to the upper apartment, where the prince already was, and by his side the young Viscount, of exactly the same age, shape, and with features not dissimilar, though Frank's were the handsomer of the two. The Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.